Our first speaker will be Abdul Al-Kalamat.
Sisters and brothers, comrades and friends, it is a great challenge to speak on the topic Malcolm X and black perspectives on the crisis of socialism at this time in our history. This is so whether we think of this country in particular or the world in general. In the last decade, we have seen an explosion of contradictions produce unprecedented changes, and we continue to see these changes unfold before our eyes virtually on a daily basis. To put together the name of Malcolm with the theoretical and practical experience of socialism is to place before us the most strategic aspects of the question being debated at the center of this storm. Can society be reorganized to produce a better quality of life than ever before, both in terms of race and nationality on the one hand, and politics and economics on the other? Further, the results of this historical debate is no mere academic exercise, but will determine how all of us will live our lives into the 21st century. There will be a new world order, and everyone will be playing by new rules. The 50-year dominance of the USA since World War II is over. Everyone who takes a serious look at the situation seems to know that. As well, every country and regional power bloc is being restructured and realigned. Thus, the debate that is raging over the future course of history is itself a historical necessity. Some would argue that history has ended. Some would argue that progress is over. And some would argue that scarcity and greed will destroy morality and reduce all society, finally, to a cash nexus, the ultimate market. These are the prophets of doom, our doom, who usually hold these beliefs as expressions of their commitment to capitalism as a system, especially their position of privilege within it. And in response to this deepening crisis we face, these forces are prepared to carry their defense of capitalism to extreme and ominous limits. Yes, once again, we face the specter of fascism from Maastricht to Moscow, from Louisiana to Latvia. On the other hand, those of us who would raise the name of Malcolm as one whose life and politics contains positive lessons for the future, and who believe that socialism remains a viable historical form of social transformation, have the awesome responsibility of revolutionary leadership, the task of historical criticism, strategic vision, and tactical action. The doomsayers offer barbarism, genocide, and war for the masses of people. Check it out. Look around you in New York. You can see advanced forms of social degeneration everywhere. But we gather here in this conference to argue the possibilities for prosperity, peace, and justice. My hope is that this session contributes to our collective grasp of socialism as a plausible scenario, and then together we can leave here and work to link this vision with the practical tasks of the day-to-day struggle. In my brief time, I would like to address then three main themes or issues. One, was Malcolm X a socialist? Two, what is the crisis of socialism? And three, what is the relationship between a black agenda and a socialist agenda? First, was Malcolm a socialist? On one level, this is one of the most controversial and easy to solve problems. No, there is no evidence that Malcolm X publicly committed himself to the principles, the scientific principles of socialism. But we can't leave it just like that, since defining people only by the text of their talk is limited at best, and usually would have to assume that their context in social practice was irrelevant, while in fact, no serious interpretation of someone's speeches and interviews can take place independent of their context and their action. Malcolm was a northern black working class voice who emerged out of the radical black tradition. Our radical black tradition is rooted in the cumulative experiences of black people's struggle for survival. Lessons paid for, learned, and encoded in a culture of resistance. The ultimate historical significance then of Malcolm X is that he reaffirmed this tradition and pushed us forward to open up the debate we are having today. The Little family in which he was born nurtured Malcolm in a cradle of Pan-Africanism, nationalism, religion, and indeed strong feminism. Earl Little, Malcolm's father, was an itinerant Baptist preacher who steeped him in the Bible as a historical paradigm of the black experience and armed him with the Old Testament ethics of revolutionary violence. Louise Little, Malcolm's mother, was a strong personality in family and politics, while connecting Malcolm to the African diaspora through her Caribbean origin in Grenada. Both of his parents were activists in Garvey's UNIA, his father being an organizer and spokesperson, and his mother an administrative official at the local level. Malcolm was snatched out of this context and put under direct white supervision, where he gave that a shot and grasped the spirit of mainstream achievement and success with an open mind. He was negated in this experience by whites in a foster home and in school, just as his parents had been negated by white terrorists and welfare bureaucrats. This was a reflection of the conditions facing black families who either tried to uphold the radical black tradition, his parents, or black youth like he himself, who try and conform to the behavior required for success by the mainstream educational institutions. Both were negated by rejection, by institutionalization, by murder. In turn, Malcolm then negated the conventions of society by striving for success in the underworld of street hustlers. This was a gangster kind of hedonism, required mainstream as much as if he were in it. And then, of course, in place of being killed, Malcolm was locked up. Now, in this scenario, the overall main contradiction is that we find the radical black tradition of the Little family liquidated by the racist terror of U.S. capitalism. In the depths of his prison experience, Malcolm was reborn within the radical black tradition through a religious conversion experience by joining the Nation of Islam. Elijah Muhammad, the leader of the Nation of Islam, became a father figure for Malcolm, as he had been for several of Malcolm's sisters and brothers. The Nation of Islam was a highly stylized form of nationalism. Elijah Muhammad was a man from Georgia with little formal education, but was wise in training his organizational representatives and devising a program. He was in direct lineage from Garvey to Noble Drew Ali to Farr to Elijah Muhammad. On the one hand, the Nation of Islam was a sectarian dogmatic organization upholding a form of black capitalism run by an authoritarian leadership, while on the other hand, its newspaper was usually edited by a black socialist who filled the pages with radical critiques of U.S. capitalism and Western imperialist interests throughout the world. Malcolm X was tormented by great conflicts within the Nation of Islam that pulled him from the dogmatism of Elijah Muhammad into the historical dynamic of the black liberation movement and world revolution. His leader's shortcoming was partly the reason, but mostly I think it was Malcolm's links with the people's movements. The motion of history drew him into the great debate of the 1960s, and he began to change and grow within that context, free of sectarianism and dogmatism. The only critical issue within that debate that sums up Malcolm's motion for at least the last 2 years of his life points to socialism. Consider the following. Malcolm took a class position. He consciously argued the case for, and I quote, the bottom of the pile Negroes, and proudly proclaimed himself a field Negro in opposition to the Uncle Tom House Negroes. And two, Malcolm declared himself a revolutionary and, among others, gave particular reference to socialist China and Cuba. Three, Malcolm noted that only white people who seemed to want what he wanted usually turned out to be socialists. And four, Malcolm finally came to the position that the struggle would not be a race war simply, but a worldwide struggle of the oppressed of the world in opposition to what he regarded as Western interests, or in other words, imperialism. In sum, for me then, the issue is not really the question, was Malcolm X a socialist, but rather the clear and undeniable fact that Malcolm X guided us to take up the issue of socialism directly and indirectly as part of the main debate driving forward the black liberation movement. Of course, Malcolm was not alone in this, but was joining the ranks of virtually all significant liberation fighters throughout the Third World. In this was Malcolm, finally, he helped to resurrect the fifth aspect of the radical black tradition that had been virtually silenced since the McCarthy purges and the isolation of such great figures as W.E.B. Du Bois, Paul Robeson, and Claudia Jones, among others. Second, what is the crisis of socialism? In the last 75 years, we have been told by the capitalists that the socialist system was dead, while the socialists have in turn charged that capitalism was moribund. But now we see the governments that proclaim socialism in such deep crisis that they are repudiating socialism, disbanding communist parties, and even destroying multinational countries in favor of a realignment based on narrow nationalist principles and the resurrection of the capitalist system. In the Soviet Union, both Yeltsin and Gorbachev uphold the capitalist direction part. They disagree on the form and function of the political structure. While there are internal and external bases for this crisis, my summation is simple. The main basis of the crisis of socialism remains capitalism. So if these historical forms of already existing socialism have died, rather than suicide, it was murder or death following a premature birth. The thesis of a premature birth is that the Marxist prescription for the development of socialism didn't quite take place. The idea was that socialism would be best constructed in a society with a developed economy, advanced technology, and an educated, culturally advanced working class with broad democratic traditions. In fact, what did happen is that virtually all 20th century socialist revolutions were in relatively undeveloped countries that took on a political form far more advanced than the economic forces and social fabric could sustain. But even as such, though with only 50 years experience, with the exception of the former Soviet Union, they were glorious experiments whose success affirms socialism, but whose failure forces us to be sober in our assessment of the freedom we have within the objective material conditions of our historical necessity. In the end, the broad masses of working people will decide the future and fate of all history, whatever they are like and whether we like it or not. So this thesis is that socialism went as far as it could go. And now in the midst of the worldwide scientific and technological revolution, its present forms are being swept aside, requiring a new, more advanced form of socialist revolution to develop. The murder of socialism thesis is that within the centralized bureaucracy of the former governments and ruling communist parties, a new bourgeoisie was created. And in some cases, it was that same old bourgeoisie that they let in. And personal privileges were generalized to the restoration of capitalism, creating an enemy headquarters within a state capitalist framework. The masses of working people became discontent with authoritarian states, an economy that fed a superstructure burdened with officials and Cold War military expenditures, and a lagging supply of quality consumer goods. The new bourgeoisie has seized the moment of this mass discontent, often propelled forward by youth influenced by Western cultural and material trends, and is using their new power to kill socialism. It's simply a place of class war. Both of these arguments have merit in explaining the last several decades, including our case of the African Americans inside the USA. We face two interrelated questions. First, the economic conditions. When has the economy polarized society into two warring classes? And two, when have white workers understood that their interests were in fighting in unity with blacks and not against blacks? The main outlines of US history seem to point to at least three times that workers rose up, twice in alliance with the bourgeoisie to carry out the National Democratic Revolution in 1776 and 1860s, the so-called American Revolution and the Civil War, and once in the Great Depression that resulted in the creation of the U.S. welfare state. The crisis of socialism in the USA is that conditions of class war have been muted by the particularities of this country. Economic expansion across diverse regions in a country with vast resources, an imperialist bribe of the workers based on third world plunder, and the collaboration of trade union bureaucrats. Finally, the most important problem has been the racism of white workers who have, more often than not, refused to unite and find common cause with the masses of black working people. And this leads to our final question. What is the relationship between a black agenda and a socialist agenda? First, let me indicate that Malcolm X lived at a time in his life in a period when the U.S. economy was expanding. This meant that U.S. imperialism was able to continue the bribe of white workers and extend to them privileges. Of course, this is relative to blacks, as in fact they remain firmly themselves in the grips of the exploitative mechanisms of capitalist class relations, because while they were white, they remain workers. A black perspective on the crisis of socialism has to come to grips with the fact that for the mass of people, there is no black agenda separate from a socialist agenda at this moment in our history. A corollary is that black unity, in a broad and uncritical way, is no longer the key to social progress. For the last 100 years or more, the black middle class has led the black liberation movement for the most part because black unity was the key to social progress, and they had the ability and inclination to lead that struggle. However, the civil rights movement fought for and won gains for a sector of this class that has become an openly right-wing Oreo Trojan horse within the black community. These are major corporate board members, high government officials, and conservative ideologues of the right. This is the final betrayal of the House Negro. For the majority of black people, the unity required for social progress is a bottom-up kind of political motion that turns the fundamental economic polarization into a staging ground for the army of oppressed, the wretched of the earth, right here. The agenda for this army is clear. On the one hand, to unleash the scientific and technological forces to sustain and create unprecedented possibilities for improvements in the quality of life by placing a serve the people principle in place of a private profit serve me principle. In sum, the crisis of socialism in the black community is the crisis of leadership. As long as the black middle class provides leadership in the illusion of inclusive black unity, that an inclusive black unity dominates political culture, black political culture, then socialism will be repudiated by black people just as Bush, Pat Buchanan, and David Duke want it to be. But when the air is clear by straight talk and straight of Malcolm, and the bottom of the pile Negroes everywhere have their say, socialism as a centerpiece of the radical black tradition will be reborn, and the possibility of a future worth living will become a practical project. Thank you.